Hey there, Russ.
Glenn, how are you?
Excellent, thanks. I'm Glenn Lowry, Economics Department, Brown University.
And I'm Ross Levine, and I'm also at the Department of Economics at Brown.
We have an intramural conversation here, Ross.
Exactly. We're just buddies chatting about what's going on in the world.
What's going on in my world is, you know, a lot of family issues and a lot of stress, and what's going on more generally is summer is over, which is really bad news for an academic. But what's going on more specifically, and the reason I was hoping that we could have this conversation for Blogging Heads, is you were at the fabled Jackson Hole meeting of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, which is where the chairman of the Fed always gives a widely reported speech, and where academics, financiers, regulators, bankers all gather to talk shop. And I just never knew anybody who was at the Jackson Hole meeting before, so I'm kind of, you know.
I've known people that have gone, but I've never gone before. It was a great experience.
Yeah.
I mean, it's part of it is just an event. There are the heads of central banks from all around the world, including from the United States. You have the head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, and you have Trichet, the head of the European Central Bank. You have the chief economists of many of the major banks in the U.S. and from around the world, and a few academics are invited to participate. And so there's a little bit of a who's who of macroeconomic and financial policy making, and all of this takes place right at the bottom of the Grand Tetons, so beautiful mountains, snow covered. So it's just quite an event to be able to go and listen to people and also had a chance to give a talk.
Yeah, you know, Thorsten Veblen, the old economist sociologist, theory of the leisure class, you remember that? so this is the leisure of the theory class, I think, on display.
Exactly.
Here. This world of high finance, you say central bankers,
right.
And you say bank regulators, but I presume that they're also the bankers themselves.
Exactly.
Who are present in large numbers. Are the investment bankers also present and represented?
No,
out there?
Commercial bankers.
Commercial bankers.
Correct.
So this is the world of money.
Oh, yeah. So when the world of money gets together, it's the money and the regulators and the central bankers. Who go to eat, talk, and hike in the Grand Tetons.
Now, why does this leave me suspicious of the possibility that the regulators who are supposed to be regulating and the bankers who are supposed to be regulated are in bed together to the extent that they're hobnobbing, socializing, and identifying one with another?
So I think that there's it's very easy to be quickly cynical, and I want to go down that route a little bit, but there's another side of this, and that is that the regulators and the central bankers, this is organized by the central banks, by the Central Bank of the United States, they have to know what's going on in the financial services industry. So it's really part of their responsibility to meet with and get to know and have open communications with the major banks around the world. So this is part of their responsibility, and I don't think that there's another way. Part of what they have to do to get soft information, to get the insights of what's going on, on the ground in finance, is to have calm opportunities to chat.
So this is what I don't understand, the importance of the informal communication. Why can't the central bankers and bank regulators get the information they need by reading reports, reading the financial press, looking at official submissions, filings, and data? Why do they have to be sipping bourbon and with their feet up, looking out at the grand, whatever they're looking at up there?
Grand Tetons.
Okay.
Grand Tetons.
Well, so what's the importance of the informality of communication? What's the nature of this information that it can't be obtained at arm's length?
So I think that I really do believe, we can get back to some of the potentially distorting effects of these type of interactions. But I do want to focus on the positive, that if you're going for a hike and you say, so, like, how bad is it out there? You know, what is it about the regulations that are causing you problems? You know, are you just kind of complaining because that's what you do in order to get profits? You know, really, what's going on? And whereas both the bankers and the regulators might have a difficult time putting things down in writing, getting to chat provides greater degree of informality and perhaps some additional information. It provides an opportunity for quick follow-up conversations. And so I think it enriches the ability of the regulators, the central bankers, to know what's going on. Indeed, part of the reason that you have in the U.S. a Federal Reserve system with the Federal Reserve banks spread throughout the United States, New York and Boston, Kansas City.
Is to keep them in touch with what's going on out in the local regions?
Exactly. And so
So what's the nature of this information? I'm sorry to sound naive, but what is it that a banker doing business day to day might know when you say, how is it out there, what's going on out there, what reports are being offered in response to that kind of question?
So I can tell you a little bit from my experience, and I'm obviously not a chief regulator or head of one of the presidents of one of the reserve banks or on the board of governors. But for example, there's a new financial reform act that was just put into place, Dodd-Frank.
Yeah, I heard about it.
And there are a lot of complaints from the bankers that this is impeding their ability to lend and hence to promote the recovery. And you get these vague types of discussions in the press. But if you go to Jackson Hole, it doesn't have to be Jackson Hole, but it's a nice enough place as anywhere else. And actually a much nicer place than most places. You have a chance to sit, whether it's, over breakfast and a cup of coffee and say, okay, so you what is it about this bill that's really a problem? And then you can go back and forth. And so the bankers might say, well, there's too many regulations. You say, well, which regulations? It's like we have these rules in place in order to curtail certain risk taking. You say, well, I understand. The banker might say, well, I understand that. But it's not curtailing risk taking, it's having these adverse effects on the bank. And this back and forth allows the regulator to sort of assess whether the bankers are communicating a legitimate complaint in the sense that maybe the regulators have imposed certain types of restrictions that really are curtailing the efficient intermediation of resources from savers to firms. Or maybe they're just trying to, fool and hoodwink the regulators in order to get them to relax a restriction that is going to allow the banks to make more profits. And so the regulators, by having this back and forth without having everything all written down, I think a wise regulator can potentially get quite a bit from that type of a discussion.
Okay, so I think it might help for us to be a little bit more concrete here. As I'm hearing you, what I'm imagining is that, so let's take Dodd-Frank. It's a piece of legislation. We can talk about the details. I'm not an expert, but it imposes various limitations and restraints on what banks can do or how they do it. Now, that may have unintended negative consequences that a regulator or no one could have anticipated in advance, but as the people who are working day-to-day in this industry try to live within these regulations, they encounter these unintended consequences. There was one in your paper that I want to actually talk more about that struck me, which was that if you increase the capital requirements of the banks, that is, require that they have more upfront investment money and be less leveraged in their investment activities, that could have the effect of changing the corporate governance of the banks so that business decisions that might enhance risk would be more likely to be taken to the extent that the bank had a more capital-intensive financing than would otherwise have been the case. Did I describe that correctly?
Yeah, so it's
so that's an unintended consequence that a bank regulator might not have known about in advance, but that he could be informed about if he hobnobs with the bankers at Jackson Hole.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I think that's exactly right. And then the regulator might disagree, but they can have this discussion. I think, for example, since we're sort of starting the semester now, it's sort of the difference between, you know, you give a multiple choice exam to a student, and you certainly elicit some information about the student's performance. But if you can have an oral exam, have a discussion about some of the questions, there's no question that you gain further insight into the student's comprehension of the material. Now, the analogy breaks down because we're not talking about student and teacher, but that type of communication and increase in information is something that does, I really think, does occur at these meetings.
Okay, well, great. Now, I want to ask you, I mean, you were there in the flesh. You were presenting an academic paper, more or less academic paper, at the conference, which is exciting. I thought maybe you should have an opportunity to discuss a little bit. Your paper is about how to think about the role of regulating financial institutions and what some of the pitfalls and problems are that can arise in the context of regulation. Again, please correct me if I'm not describing that rightly. But in any case, I want to invite you to tell us some of what you were after and how the audience responded in the presentation that you made at Jackson Hole.
Okay, so let me start somewhere we can kind of go as we go with the conversation. So the title of the paper says a lot. So the title of the paper is Regulating Finance and Regulators to Promote Growth.
Okay, good. We're regulating both finance and we're regulating the regulators of finance.
Exactly. All right. And so this let's kind of go with this conversation about, okay, there are some benefits associated with the regulators being surrounded by the financial services industry, because that's a way in which they obtain information.
Okay, information.
But part of my paper is that, yes, I understand that, but there are potentially adverse effects from those close interactions between the regulator and the regulated. And so here I think the best analogy comes from sports. And so there's an economist, a financial professor at Chicago, Tobias Moskowitz, and he had a boyhood friend who's now a writer at Sports Illustrated, Jan Wernheim, and they have a book that asks a very simple question. Why does the home team win such a disproportionate percentage of its games? This happens in baseball, American football, soccer around the world, hockey. I can't remember all the sports. I mean, basketball, cricket.
How do you explain the home team advantage?
How do you explain the home team advantage?
Yeah.
And the great thing is that for an academic and economist like we are, is Tobias Moskowitz has lots and lots of data. And so what they argue is that it's not player performance. Players do not systematically perform better at home. So, for example, if you look at foul shots in the NBA, individuals' foul shots are almost identical home and away. Not for every single player, of course, but on average.
Despite the fact that there are those wild fans in back of the basket waving their noodles or whatever it is to try to throw the opposing player off, the home team shooter still doesn't have an advantage in shooting foul shots on the home court.
Exactly, but those fans, those wild fans with the waving things and everything, they do play a really crucial role. And the role that they play is they influence the referees. So what this book concludes across many, many sports with lots and lots of data is that the umpires, the referees, mm-hmm. the officials, they're not biased for a particular team. They're biased in favor of the home crowd.
And I could see the analogy. So the regulator is going to be biased in favor of the guys they have drinks with after work. And if those are bankers, then you don't get as an effective banking regulation.
Exactly. I mean, the home crowd is the financial services industry. If we go with this a little bit too far, it's like the public. If the public, Joe Public can get even a ticket to this game, it's far off in the bleachers, and his or her screams and yells, are not, heard as clearly as the financial services industry, which is sitting courtside.
Okay, so now I want to ask you about this because it seems your account, the umpire bias account of relatively ineffective financial regulation or overly bank-sympathetic financial regulation is too kind to bank regulators in that you don't mention money. You don't talk about, you know, people who are thinking about 10 years, 20 years down the line, where am I going to be, you know, in terms of my career or what my options are or what my opportunities are. I'm not saying people are being bribed, right, but I'm saying there's a huge amount of money on the table. And, you know, I don't see that having any analogous counterpart in the case of sporting events.
I don't disagree. So as an economist, I'm very attuned to incentives. And so when one looks at the revolving door meaning that people from the financial service industry go and become regulators and central bankers, and then those same regulators and central bankers go back to the financial services industry.
Yeah.
So this issue of, you know, I want to keep that lucrative door open when I'm done, you know, doing my civil service to the country. I understand that. And, you know, in a book that I have coming out, you know, we document how prevalent that is. But my problem with that, with putting too much emphasis on that money issue, is that I know many of these regulators and central bankers, and I don't believe that that's the primary influence, at least in the United States. That I am much more attracted to this home field advantage story of why there's regulatory bias, because it explains why people I know and respect would argue, you know, very, very, very vigorously that they have no bias and they are simply looking out for the public interest. Just as an umpire would argue vigorously, okay, that there is no way he is biased toward any team or the home crowd. But when you show him or her the statistics, a sports umpire, it's right there. And so I, rather than arguing that the regulators are corrupt, which I just don't see, it's much more easy for me to argue that regulators are human. And human beings have this natural bias towards making peace within the community that they operate most frequently and comfortably. And so that's why I don't have proof of that, so I understand where you're coming from in your questioning, but that's where
I got to put on my Huey P. Long hat here, my rabid populist demagogic hat here, and say to you the following. Some people in this country are damned mad that we've got a 9%+ unemployment rate, that we've got houses underwater and mortgages in default all over the land, that we've got 401ks that have bottomed out and gone through the floor with people's defined contribution retirement plans, and that the economy is stalled and we're hurting, while bankers, okay, this is the caricature, this is the kind of cartoon view of the things, are paying themselves bonuses, making profits hand over fist, getting bailed out by the government, too big to fail and doing just fine. Okay.
Yep.
Now, we people who are mad as hell about this are damn sure not sympathetic with bankers. And we're finding we're having a hard time understanding how those who are elected or appointed by elected officials to represent the public interest can be overly sympathetic with bankers. In other words, who they're sympathetic with, who they understand themselves to be
friends
with, of the same sort, is endogenous. It depends on the politics that's going on behind the scene. Why don't they identify with working people? Why don't they identify with the taxpayers? Why don't they identify with, you know, public employees of municipalities that are going under or whatever it is, you know? Okay, so I'll stop my Huey P. Long rant and just leave it at that. The regulators who have this umpire bias, what I'm trying to understand is why they're sympathetic to the bankers as the home team. Why they define bankers as the home team and don't define Main Street as the whole team. So we're the ones who pay them.
Yeah, so I think that there's a couple of things. So I think one is, and I want to come back to, I think people really are angry, and this anger is mixed with confusion about what happened. And so this anger can get, you know, kind of focused on a lot of things.
Okay.
I think that, kind of going back, I think that they're very, very reasonable people can disagree about why the regulators, especially over the 10, 15, 20 years before the most recent crisis, were biased in favor of the financial services industry. Okay, so the populist might say it was the attraction of money to regulators once they left their regulatory offices. Okay?
Right.
I might argue that it's this home field bias, that essentially the regulators are surrounded by the financial services industry, and so it's not that they're corrupt, it's just that in that social milieu, they're sort of biased in a particular direction. One way or the other, okay, those two views kind of end up in the same place, and that is the regulators are not working for us.
They're on the same page there. Whatever the reasons why they're not working for us, the bottom line is they're not working for us.
Correct. And so I think that in sort of the I agree, and I think that the policies in the 10 to 15 years prior to the crisis were systematically biased in favor of allowing the financial services industry to extract enormous profits.
Right.
And the regulators didn't focus on the types of risk that this was creating for vast majority of the people. And then there was the bailout once the crisis hit. So what, regardless of the motivation, I think the issue is, how do we make the regulators work for us? And I'm glad you kind of advertised that, because the title of this book with Jim Barth and Jerry Caprio is Guardians of Finance.
Okay, so you had the paper at Jackson Hole, but that is like a prelude to
the book,
a book project, which is well advanced now, and you're about to describe it.
Yeah, so the title kind of describes what we've been talking about. It's the Guardians of Finance making regulators work for us. And so I think that, you know, part of the book is really getting rid of a lot of the noise and complications and focusing on the systematic biases that occurred in order to take the next step of how do we reduce this. You know, we make a suggestions in our book.
Before you talk about I just want to dwell just for a moment on this point about bias. I remember when the president famously now described Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO at Goldman Sachs, as a savvy businessman.
Yep.
Remember that?
Yep.
Now, let me stipulate that he's a savvy businessman. But my point is that, I mean, you know, you could go into how savvy could he be if you have to bail out, whatever. But let me stipulate. My point is that, now here we got people who are making eight figures and nine figures in a year. We're talking about people who are very, very wealthy, extremely powerful. We're talking about networks of people. You know, they've been secretaries of the Treasury. They've had high positions in government. They've been doing deals all over the world. They know what's going on in China, what's going on in Europe, what's going on all throughout the world. They've got friends who are running huge companies, which are employing hundreds of thousands of people in a global setting. Extremely powerful. So this is rarefied territory. I'm running for office. I'm trying to raise $1 billion in order to get myself elected president. I go to Wall Street. These are the people who I'm having dinner with at the $10,000 a plate dinners and so forth and so on. I decide that I want to have a closed-door meeting with some savvy business people to talk about whatever the issue is of the day, and I call 20 or 30 of them these are the people who are around the table when these deals are going down. Yeah. And while it may not be corruption, there certainly could be seduction of people by the aura of this power and this money. And the thing I'm after here, Ross, is, you know, the legitimacy of the inequalities that we have in our society, like people who are making $200 million a year, or people who are paying themselves huge bonuses, or people who are controlling vast financial resources and are making decisions that have huge yep. implications for millions of people, the aura that surrounds them, the kind of can seduce a president of the United States, let alone a bank regulator. And there's another sensibility, one that would look at Lloyd Blankfein not as a savvy business, not as a meritocrat, somebody whose wealth, power, and all the rest has been earned because he was just at the head of the class. He was number one. Somebody who would look at him as a robber baron, what did the Cornell as a plutocrat, as an oligarch, as one of 10,000 people running the world, anti-democratic, plutocratic. And that would be a very different sensibility, and a person who came with that ideological sensibility would be less likely to be seduced by the fact that the guy's wearing a Rolex, or that he summers in a Swiss Alps summer resort, or that he knows the guy who was the last Secretary of the Treasury.
Yeah, so...
I'm sorry, that was a rant,
That's kind of big. So, I mean, I don't want to demonize Lloyd Blankfein. I know you don't either. You're sort of kind of...
No, he's just an example because they mentioned him in that comment.
I know that. So I think... I think that the... I'm going to avoid the question a little bit, and then I'm going to ask you.
Okay.
So I think that the financial sector is extremely powerful. Okay, the financial sector is extremely powerful because, you know, it mobilizes resources and then it decides who gets to use those resources.
Yes.
If it makes those decisions well, then capital and hence opportunity, this is the key thing, and hence opportunity flow to the people with the best ideas and the most entrepreneurial energy. If the financial system doesn't do its job very well, then capital tends to flow to the people who already have a lot of wealth, or have a lot of political connections, or both. And in most countries around the world, the financial system doesn't do very well, and capital tends to flow to a very narrow segment of people in society. One of the things that's distinguished the U.S. on average, mm-hmm. and compared to other countries, is that the financial system has tended to do a comparatively good job at expanding opportunities. Not as good as we would hope it would do in the long, you know, if we could make things better, but certainly compared to most societies. However, one could question whether that's been distorted a lot over the last decade or two. And so I think that when you say that when I say that the financial sector is powerful, it can be powerful both for good by expanding opportunities, but if distorted, it can be powerful in a very, you know, pernicious manner, by allowing a few to extract enormous wealth and leave everyone with the bill. And I think that's partly what has happened, and hence, you know, people are justifiably really angry. But now we're left with this problem. If you get rid of the financial sector, you know, or you severely restrict its ability to intermediate credit effectively, okay, you can curtail economic opportunities, which is what we see in many countries, and hence... not only do you hurt growth, but you also sort of hurt the opportunities of people who don't have the advantages of their families having accumulated a lot of wealth. And so we're in a difficult position where right now something is seriously wrong, and the problem is getting us to move in a direction where the financial sector operates effectively again. And so... I understand, and I too am very angry. But how that anger manifests itself in actual policies now will have really big implications for the things that you're talking about, the things that we care about in the coming decades.
Okay, so you're worried that my kind of demagogic and populist thing might overshoot and end up overregulating or doing things that would make matters worse, not better, in reaction to...
I think I'm thinking two things. Actually, let me ask you, because yeah. people are angry.
Yes.
I mean, you've voiced that, but you don't... So I was hoping that anger would manifest itself in kind of a serious rethinking and change. And instead, what Obama did is he appointed the same people, or many of the same people, that got us into this mess. So there was very little change. So the question is, why hasn't, where is this anger coming out? You know, so like, well, people are mad, but like, how is it sort of, where is it going?
I think it's very clear that the anti-establishmentarian energies in American politics are now on the right. They're with the so-called Tea Party, and the people who run for president saying, I'm going to make the federal government as inconsequential in your life as I can possibly make it. At least that's the way it seems to me, that discrediting, the sort of demystification, right? I mean, I think about this a little bit the way I imagine a sociologist would think about it. I mean, you have, you know, we economists talk about the mechanisms and the engines of inequality, resource allocation, economic growth, and so on. But there's also the interpretation or the meanings that end up getting attached to economic events. And I think about the kind of demystification, right? I mean, people making huge sums. Now, you know, in the back of our minds, that can only be legitimate because we think they've, quote, earned these sums. We think they are smart, quote, unquote. We think they're doing something that's really, you know, very special, that's very rarefied, that very few people can really do. And so when they get huge rewards for doing the things that we imagine that very few people can do, that we imagine are valuable, that we imagine are the fruit of hard work and self-application, we accept the fact that they have more, and it becomes legitimate. Right. Conversely, when the curtain gets pulled back and we see the Wizard of Oz back there,
yep,
you know what I'm saying? Pulling a bunch of levers, a lot of smoke and a whole lot of bells and whistles, but we don't any longer believe the hype that these are special people, it's a narrow portal that only the geniuses can get through, that, the, you know, it's a burning the midnight oil to 3 o'clock in the morning and making America the special place that it is. Instead, right, we think that it's a bunch of guys doing deals and you know, fixing the rules in order to suit themselves. Once that curtain is pulled and that demystification occurs, then they're illegitimate and they're right targets for, you know, for political action and maybe for self-destructive, you know, populist reactions that would end up doing things that would hurt the average person, even though they're aimed at, you know, smacking the bankers down.
Yeah,
that's how I see it.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think though it's, there's, it's like the free floating anger. It can manifest itself in a couple of ways. One would be to sort of really restrict the financial services industry through lots of regulation.
Yep.
And that's one way. Or it could just be an anger at Washington for perhaps, you know, bailing out the bankers, in which case what might happen now is sort of less regulation by kind of saying we want Washington to have a very minimal role in our life. And so what I'm seeing again, and this is what happened in the decade or two before the crisis, is you get the worst mixture, because, you know, as academic economists, you know, we can sit around and enjoy ourselves forever saying, you know, should there be no government,
right,
should there be lots of government. But the fact of the matter is, especially in financial regulation, okay, there are thousands and thousands of regulators in the United States.
Yeah.
And there are tons and tons of regulators. Okay, that's not going to go away. So it's a matter of, do we have the proper mixture?
Now, okay? I want to ask you something, or at least talk about something. I want to get your opinion on Dodd-Frank, but I also want to, first I want to ask you this. And this is a layperson, so I'm not a finance expert. I'm an economist, but I'm not a finance expert. But I'm looking at this, and I'm thinking, and I was especially led to think this after I read last summer this article about Sheila Bair, the comptroller of the currency?
No, she was a former head of the FDIC,
the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation,
right,
which has a major role in bank regulation. And she was kind of a naysayer in something. There was a big profile of her last summer in the New York Times Sunday Magazine.
Yeah, by Joe Nocera.
Indeed, by Joe Nocera, a financial journalist of some notoriety. And she was saying, you know, she thought that Bear Stearns should have been allowed to fail and not bail it out. Investment banks fail, she said, you know. And the difference between commercial banking, where you have a deposit insurance guarantee, where the government is guaranteeing depositors that they won't lose their savings, and investment banking, where people are high-flying and taking more risk, is that the latter can be allowed to fail. Now, the shareholders will get wiped out. Maybe the bondholders will get wiped out. But life will go on in due course. You unwind them in some orderly fashion and you let them fail. And so she was a naysayer to decision. And when I was reading this, what I was thinking was, every one of these crises management situations is fraught with decision nodes, that is, points where people have to go left or right, where somebody's bottom line could be profoundly affected.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we got toxic assets out there. We got balance sheets that are not in line. Somebody's got to write something down. Well, whoever writes it down is going to take a hit, you know, or their shareholders are going to take a hit, or their bondholders are going to take a hit. And so this allocation of the taking of the hit.
Yep.
Okay. So now, obviously, nobody wants to take a hit.
Right.
You know, if you're the person who has to say, hey, you right there, you're getting ready to take a hit. You used to be worth this. Now you're worth nothing.
Yep.
Okay. That's a tremendous amount of power.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question I'm trying to ask, or the issue I'm trying to raise is, should we have confidence that that power, when it's exercised in boardrooms at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, or the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve in Washington, D.C., or the Department of Treasury of the United States of America, when there are 40 people sitting around the table, including secretaries and undersecretaries and bank regulators of one stripe or another, and various financiers and principals who are going to be asked to do this or that in order to resolve in an orderly fashion whatever the crisis, near bank run, panicky situation might be, can I be confident that there is not an insider bias, an umpire bias, let's protect our guys, you know, these guys have been rich all their lives, you know, we're going to wipe them out, we're going to kill them. You know, can I be confident that that's being done in the public interest as opposed to in the interest of the private parties who all are scratching each other's back, hiring each other 2 years out, and doing deals with each other over the course of a professional lifetime?
No.
No!
Next question.
Well, that's very interesting and very useful information.
So there's just a couple of things. So on sports, I go back to the sports, and so I really love this book because what they show is that the bias, okay, that umpires, you know, have, is particularly acute in the close times, the really key calls in close games,
mm-hmm.
when things really matter, when the crowd is really going crazy, okay, and you actually, this bias is even bigger when the crowd is closer to the field of play, but it's at the key moments, that's when the bias is greatest. You don't see so much bias in kind of runaway games and kind of when things are not too important. When the thing is really on the line, okay, I think that that's where this bias will also manifest itself in the financial, in kind of financial decisions as well. So on Sheila Bair, she's sort of a hero in certain respects. I don't know her, her personally at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that many people, and this comes out in the Joe Nocera article, sort of say, you know, she's not a team player. But what I like, and this was came from there's a nice phrase that was used by Alan Meltzer, who is a professor at Carnegie Mellon.
Yes.
He was at the Jackson Hole, and he talked about the esprit de corps among the Federal Reserve presidents and board members. And one of the things he kind of mentioned is while there are positive elements of the esprit de corps, there are negative elements in that you need to have people genuinely and forcefully express their views, especially when it comes to projecting the interests of the public at large. And while Sheila Bair may have ruffled a few feathers, you know, that's what she did. And I think that you know, she's really a model civil servant, and, you know, she did not win a lot of the battles, but in, like, all of the cases that I could see, she was genuinely fighting for she was genuinely fighting for the public at large.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think
I got to tell you a story, Ross, which will seem weird, but I think it's related. Okay, so
good.
For years and years, I wrote and thought and did research about and on the question of affirmative action.
Right.
Okay, racial affirmative action, gender affirmative action. So I don't want to go into details of affirmative action, but I want to say one of the issues that comes up there is the value of diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And one of the arguments that I find really quite compelling is the so-called chaperone argument, which is to say there are some situations where, okay, let me give the following example. We got a bunch of guys who are the board of directors, or they're the senior hiring committee or whatever it is, and it's a bunch of guys.
Okay.
They meet, they sit around a table, and they tell a lot of jokes, okay? So some of the issues have to do with, should we hire Mr. X or Ms. Y, okay?
Right.
And, you know, these guys are going to be doing locker room stuff, and, you know, they're going to be laughing, and, you know, they're somewhat disciplined. But there's still a gender bias that's kind of in the air. I mean, and that may not even be aware of it, you know? Mm-hmm. But when there's a woman who's present at that room who kind of chaperones the collective deliberation,
right.
Now the nature of the bias or the kind of informal, you know, unexamined leaning one way or the other is changed dramatically.
Right.
In part because the woman is there and she can speak up. But in part because the guys, each of them know that the other guys know that the woman is there.
Right.
And they don't want to be seen by another guy as being the kind who would say this or that in the presence of a woman.
Right.
Likewise, with respect to racial issues, sometimes it really is important that there be an African-American in the room. I know in the classrooms when I'm teaching sensitive material that have to do with racial inequality, and my students are trying to find a way to discuss matters one way or this or that and say, you know, what's on their minds. It is dramatically different to have a diversified audience. Okay, that's all. That's all by way of saying, well, let's diversify the ranks of the people who are exerting a power. I mean, this is not such a rocket science kind of enterprise that only, you know, the chosen few who've gone through the initiation rite and know that special handshake can be allowed in the room.
Yep.
What's wrong with letting some left wingers? So, hey, people like me, I'm literate, I'm an economist. I'm not advocating anything, I don't want a job, I'm just saying.
Hey, we need you at Brown.
No, don't make it personal. I'm not advocating for anything. But I'm just saying that there are intelligent people who could be in the room and be a part of those conversations who would feel much closer to, who know personally, who, you know, just last week when they were visiting their Aunt Sarah, had a conversation with a working class person, you know somebody who's unemployed. Feel the pain of the African American or Hispanic communities or the lower class, rural, whatever it might be. So diversity, opening things up a little bit and letting in other voices. Is that just kind of naive talk, or is there anything to that?
So, I sort of agree with everything you say that there are huge advantages to diversity. You know, many of them, you know, sort of you don't see directly in any particular decision, but in the whole process of evaluating, you better get a better group and a better decision and a better environment. And I agree that on these big issues, you know, you want people who are not only surrounded by a narrow segment of society. So I understand that. My concern is, though, is that you put somebody in that environment, okay, and they're surrounded by the same home crowd.
Yeah.
They're going to feel certainly a little bit insecure. Much of what goes in finance, just as, you know, many other very technical disciplines, is difficult to know all of the nitty-gritty. And so it can be difficult to sort of defend your view in an area in which you're really not an expert. On kind of big decisions, yes, but on a lot of the technical issues, I'm not so sure. So, for example, I remember teaching the class, my financial institutions class, during 2008 as things started to come to the fore.
Yeah.
And the students were like, you know, just let Citibank and Bank of America fail. You know, that way you would avoid sort of the incentive problems. And what I would tell them is, you know, I understand the principle because, you know, I taught it to you. but imagine you're sitting, you know, or you're laying in bed. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. You're staring at the ceiling. Okay, experts from around the world have been calling you all day, telling you that if you let these banks fail, okay, it is going to be an order of magnitude worse than the Great Depression.
Yeah.
Okay? Do you have so much confidence in your moral hazard and the efficiency of markets that you still make that decision the next day? So I think that's a tough call, but it means that there is a technical expertise there that's important. I'm not against the diversity. But you bring up something else that I think I would advocate. And so when you talk about sort of having diversity in the room, because part of what it does is it affects the decisions of other people.
Yes.
They think differently. So the story you told is when there's a woman in the room, the men behave differently.
Right, toward each other, indeed.
That this again, you know, maybe too much sports, but this again, you see in sports. So, for example, when they electronically monitor the balls and strikes of umpires, okay, and they can see that there's a home field bias, sometimes the umpire knows that he or she is being monitored, and sometimes the umpire does not know. When the umpire knows that they're being monitored, the bias falls.
Yeah.
There's some sort of subconscious change that goes on, very much like what you're talking about. I think in financial regulation, there has to be a mechanism through which the public can have some sort of an instant replay or electronic monitoring of the regulators. My sort of view is that assessing financial regulation is really complex. You know, that if you took the economics departments of sort of Harvard and MIT, that's not enough. Okay, no lawyers there. Okay, no accountants there, and, you know, probably not too many people with private sector experience.
Yeah.
You really need a team to assess the information, and they have to have the ability to get whatever information they need. So from my perspective, right now the public is not part of this because there's no way for them to get the information, and they don't have the expertise to assess it. While the regulators are partially responsible for doing that, they, by the very nature of the fact that they're in daily contact with the financial services industry, which they must be to perform their role, but they're therefore biased. There has to be some sort of an instant replay or electronic monitoring. We need some additional institution to help in assessing. So that's a way in which I would suggest is an additional mechanism for getting this diversity as part of the decision-making process.
Now, what about critical input from the academic community who have the expertise, and presumably because they're not being paid by banks but instead are taking the piddly sums that we receive for compensation for our services, they should be more independent and able to sort of, that's what you're doing, as I understand it, kind of an independent critical assessment of the system and so on. But isn't that the job of journalism and the academy to provide that kind of informed but not biased assessment?
Yes, but. The problem is that, as you know, at least some of us in academia are not always good about playing with others. And we're rewarded for being independent researchers. And so things tend to get done, sort of a little atomistic, laboratory spread all over the place. And journalists, similarly, they have their areas of expertise, but they're writing stories for their individual outlets.
Yeah.
And you need coordinated teams, hundreds of people to sift through the information that comes in from across, the spectrum of financial institutions and markets. Surely academics and journalists play a role in this whole process, but they simply don't have the coordinated expertise to do it.
Okay.
And they don't have, I can ask the Fed for information, they'll say no, and there's these cases where through a Freedom of Information Act, the court said that the Fed had to give the information to Bloomberg, And the Fed basically delayed for 3 years through a whole variety of appeals, and then when it finally gave the information, it gave it in sort of a non-searchable form of thousands and thousands of pages.
What was this, in this example, what's the information pertaining to?
So in this example, the information was pertaining to where the Fed lent taxpayers' money to the banks when it prevented them from going bankrupt, which seems...
We don't know where the money went?
We do now, but it took 3 years and a series of court fights all the way up to the Supreme Court.
That's interesting. We're running out of time here. Dodd-Frank. So it's been demonized by all the Republican presidential candidates. You need to repeal Dodd-Frank. It's been pointed to as overregulation, regulation run amok, socialist Obama administration, blah, blah. What is the informed view from an objective and publicly interested expert on finance about Dodd-Frank?
So I think there's a great quotation from, and this is, comes from the 19th century by a banker about some new regulations that were put in on railroads. It was put in place on kind of regulating railroads because there were lots of accidents. And he said, you know, this is a great bill because it's kind of like lots and lots and lots and lots of words, and it makes it seem to the public like something great and grand is being done, when in actuality, nothing is really happening. And I think that's sort of my view of Dodd-Frank.
Wow.
If Dodd-Frank had been passed 20 years ago, it would have made very little difference. I was very disappointed. Most of Dodd-Frank gives huge discretion. It gives just additional discretionary power to the Fed and the SEC to do their studies, make reports, and kind of go forward. But the problem, again, is why should we believe that the decisions that the Fed and the SEC and other regulatory institutions make are going to be made in the best interest of the public, given that there's some potential biases influencing their decisions? And so I think that it is a huge layer of confusion. And unfortunately, I think the criticism from the right, while I think that their dismay with Dodd-Frank is right, I think the notion that the answer is to just remove regulations is exactly wrong.
But is it harmful? I mean, it sounds like you're saying it's innocuous. It doesn't make any, doesn't help, doesn't hurt. But the right-wing people are saying, no, it's part of the overregulation that's hurting the economy and impeding the recovery.
I'm reluctant to say that it's impeding the recovery. I think that the slow recovery is a lot. There are a lot of factors. Recoveries tend to be slow after huge financial crises. Recoveries tend to be slow after big real estate busts, and we've had both. While I'm not a fan of Dodd-Frank, I'm reluctant to blame it for the slow recovery. I think the problem, though, is that financial regulation played a big role in getting us into this mess, where the mess is not just the crisis. The mess is that we kind of allocated credit to the wrong places. And so we need to fix the regulatory environment so that the financial services industry, as powerful as it is, has the right incentives to seek out the best investments. And so Dodd-Frank doesn't do anything except make us feel like we did something, then we're not fixing a broken system. And that will impede opportunity and growth. And so that's why I think Dodd-Frank is a big problem.
So, okay, one of the concrete kind of proposals that I've heard floated around is to do something, you know, this is on relief for homeowners whose mortgages are underwater or whatever.
Right.
So the housing market implodes, the value of these assets, these houses that we own, falls, the market value of them falls, but we have these mortgages, we borrowed money against these assets, we owe the money. Now, if the value of the house falls, whatever money we put down may get wiped out, and indeed we may end up with a house that's worth less than what we owe the bank. And so we're bearing all the risk of the fluctuation of the price of the house, that is, we homeowners. We're bearing all that risk. Our down payment gets wiped out, and if the house falls below the value of the market, if the value in the market of the house falls below what is owed on it, we still owe the face value of the mortgage. Okay, So the people who loaned us the money for the house are taking no risk, at least theoretically, if we pay. They're taking no risk relative to the fluctuating value of houses. Now, some people are coming along now and saying, well, that should be modified in one way or another. Maybe bankruptcy laws should be changed, or other laws should be changed so as to allow for homeowners to be protected. Maybe we wipe out any down payment that they put down, but if the value of the house falls below what they owe on the house, then the bank has to eat that. Or there's a renegotiation of the relationship between the homeowner and the bank, in which part of that loss is borne by the bank. Now, that's all ex post facto. That is, when the banks went into the deal, they assumed that they were going to get paid 100%. The whole idea was the borrower was bearing the risk.
Right.
But if the effect of millions of borrowers being underwater is to depress the economy because of the debt overhang at blah, 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 and if equity tells us that if banks are too big to fail, then the government and taxpayers have to bail out the financial sector, then maybe there ought to be some extraordinary relief for the those taxpayers who find themselves in that tough situation. That's kind of a countervailing argument. And I just, in concluding our conversation, wanted to get your expert opinion on that kind of question about the policies toward relieving the debt overhang problem in the mortgage, in the housing market.
Yeah, I think this is key. I think part of what's going on is that if a homeowner owes more than the house is worth, he or she can just give the house back to the bank.
Yeah, they just stop paying their credit might be hurt.
Paying.
They go bankrupt in effect.
Correct, and then that's it. The bank can't go after other assets because the collateral for the loan is simply the house. Now the person does lose his or her house. And the down payment, of course,
yeah.
But the person can walk away. But this is having a depressing effect throughout the whole economy because I think there's something along, and I'm not an expert on this, there's something along the lines of 2 or 3 million houses that are soon going to be foreclosed upon. So this is helping depress housing prices. People are less wealthy. It hurts their expenditures. They have more difficulty moving if there are job opportunities somewhere else because they don't want to realize the losses on their homes. They can't sell their homes, and so this is a big mess. And part of what's going on is the bankers don't want to recognize that there's a loss on the house because then this would hurt their asset position. They would look worse in the market.
And so there are
some proposals floating around to provide some type of relief to facilitate, to foster sort of the renegotiation loan between the bank and the homeowner. I think that's going to be, that's key not just in terms of the equity, and equity is important, but that's also key for the recovery since the housing market is slowing that down.
Yeah.
So I don't have a, it's, there's a number of proposals. I don't have a, I don't, there's not one that I sort of, you know, kind of feel is particularly good, but.
Well, okay. I mean, I think we've spent a good hour here talking about finance. We still left a lot of stuff untouched upon, but we can have another conversation, Ross.
It's always fun talking with you, Glenn.
Finance is powerful. That's one thing I come away from this conversation with. It's powerful both for economic growth, getting the capital resources to the right sources, to the right destinations, but it's also powerful for inequality, for social inequality. And
for good and bad.
Indeed. So,
you know, and I learned that from the paper you wrote like 1981.
That was 1981. That would be 30 years ago, bloggingheads.tv fans. I was a baby, but I was writing papers.
Yeah, and it shaped, your paper shaped my career.
Oh, my God, Ross. That's very flattering to hear you say.
It's true.
All right. Well, you guys ought to read that paper. That's July 1981 Econometrica. Intergenerational Transfers and the Distribution of Earnings. Thanks, Ross.
I'm not sure it's going to make the top 10 list.
No, I don't think so. It's got a few equations in it. I warned the readers out there in advance. Ross, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. We'll do it again.
Take care. I'll see you tomorrow.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye.